Okay, this is lecture number 5 in our series of lectures on ethics. We didn't finish up euthanasia. In fact, we just barely started euthanasia. And so let's pick it up where we left off. Remember when we discussed euthanasia, we mentioned that there are several different types of euthanasia. There's passive euthanasia, and there's active euthanasia. Of course, active euthanasia, you actively do something to kill a person. And passive euthanasia, you just neglect to do something that you could have done to sustain the life. Now, under active euthanasia, it's always wrong. People aren't horses. You don't put a human being to death to stop the pain. Human life is sacred. Passive euthanasia, though, it could be unnatural. Or it could be natural. So you could have unnatural passive euthanasia, and you could have natural passive euthanasia. The natural passive euthanasia can be justified. That's something that hasn't even been, you know, the courts, the doctors pull plugs on a regular basis. They bring in some old lady that she's dying of cancer, and they got her hooked up to all this stuff, and then they realize, hey, she's going to die within a few hours. And what's that? Yeah, we just started, yep. And I'm just reviewing what I covered last week. Well, you weren't paying attention last week anyway, so. But natural passive euthanasia, you don't actively take the life, you don't do something that you could do, which actually would prolong the death, but you allow them to die naturally of their disease. Okay? So it's their disease. It's they die of a natural thing, the disease that's killing them. Unnatural passive euthanasia, though, whatever you neglect to do for them, that's what kills them. In other words, if you withhold air when you have the medical means to give them air, they don't die from the disease, they die because they don't have air. Or they die because they don't have water or food when you could have fed them intravenously, okay? So unnatural passive euthanasia is murder. An active euthanasia is murder. But natural passive euthanasia is not, because the person just dies from what they're dying from. Francis Schaeffer chose not to have chemotherapy and chose just to have the bare minimum of medication to numb the pain, but he wanted to just die naturally rather than spend the rest of his life in a hospital bed with all kinds of things. There's nothing wrong with that at all. Living will, if you had a living will that just said something along those lines, along the natural passive euthanasia lines, that wouldn't be bad. Problem is, a lot of people are coming up with living wills that are just saying, you know, If I get cancer, shoot me or give me a lethal injection, you know, active euthanasia or passive unnatural euthanasia. But keep in mind those distinctions. You will see them on a test. Assistant Pastor Gary Tronson, he was visiting a lady dying, and I don't even know if she's still hanging in there. But for the past week, he was visiting a lady in the hospital who was dying, not a person who was a member of the church. And when you do that, you will hear doctors talking about this kind of stuff. And sometimes they might even come up to the pastor and ask him for his input about what should be done. And so, yes, you'll see it again on a test, but more important than that, you know, you might have a loved one who might be hooked up to a machine, and you might get asked some questions, and you need to draw the distinction. As we study on this lecture, we're going to try to make some guidelines that will make it more and more clear to you what is permissible and what is not permissible. You don't have to prolong somebody's death, but at the same time, you should not take their life. But by euthanasia, for the rest of the lecture, and Geiser does this in his textbook as well, by euthanasia, we're really going to key on active and passive unnatural euthanasia. In other words, what we've already decided was not murder. Even though you can call it euthanasia, we're not going to really... When we say euthanasia from here on in, we're talking about the unethical euthanasia. Rather than allow somebody to die naturally, you either through neglect kill them or you actively kill them. Okay? But both active and passive unnatural euthanasia both directly cause the person to die. It's either something you did active or something you didn't do passive, but it was some action or lack of action on your part that caused them to die, not the disease that they were dying from. Now this Kevorkian guy, he's not even up on the board. I mean, he just somebody's got Alzheimer's or something and wants to die, and this guy's, oh fine, I'll bring my machine over tomorrow. And you're not even talking about somebody who's got a disease that's going to eventually kill them in that case. Euthanasia can also be classified as voluntary or involuntary. Mercy killing, euthanasia means mercy killing, and you know, involuntary mercy killing. It's like, I just got to pour some mercy on you and put you to death, even though you don't want to die. You know, it's kind of almost a contradiction in terms. But several years ago, back in 1990, Holland legalized voluntary euthanasia. Since then. And Geiser wrote this book in, what, 92 or 93? And 80. Anyway, it says copyright 89, but he has down to 1990 that they legalized. I might have got this information somewhere else, though. Anyway, after that note, since then, though, over 1,000 non-voluntary euthanasias have occurred. So they legalized in Holland voluntary euthanasia, and now over 1,000 involuntary have occurred. A slippery slope. Once you start putting people out of their misery, killing people who want to die, lo and behold, a little bit later, you're playing Adolf Hitler and putting people out of their misery because they don't meet your definition of a master race or a perfect human being. Euthanasia can also be self-caused, that's suicide, or caused by another, and that's homicide. So it could be self-caused or caused by another. It could be voluntary or non-voluntary. As we mentioned, euthanasia means mercy killing. Literally, it means good death. But mercy killing is the normal layman's term for it. Infanticide is a type of euthanasia. Infanticide. And that's the killing of babies already born. Okay? Abortion, the babies are killed before they're born. Infanticide, the babies are already born, and it's the homicide of an infant. So it's the killing of an infant who was already born. Watson and Crick, remember these guys for breaking the DNA, the code and all, they won the Nobel Prize and all. Their view is that we should not declare a newborn human until they're 3 days old. That way the parents and the doctor could examine the baby for any defects, and then they could just kill the baby before that three-day period if it doesn't meet up to our perfect definition of what a human being should be. And And so but what they're basically saying is, look, what Watson and Frigger are saying is, look, let's stop playing a game. We all know that life starts at conception. It's one of the most obvious things of biology. Life starts at the moment of conception. But if we played God and randomly said that life doesn't start until the baby is born, then why not extend it 3 more days? And say 3 days after the baby's born, and then we can get rid of a lot of the foreign babies that's going to cost a lot of money to take care of. And get rid of a lot of unwanted babies and stuff. So they're basically saying, look, we're playing God, and Watson and Crick like playing God. They're saying we should just play God 3 days longer than we do right now, and we can get rid of more of these undesirables. Now, you know, again, these are the same things that we slammed Adolf Hitler for in the 1950s. Now our Nobel Prize winners are promoting in the 1990s. We're entering into a brave new world, and it's going to be. If anybody's ever read B.F. Skinner's, some of his work, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, where we should be programmed in accordance with the politically correct intellectual elite. But things are not looking real good at this point. A case of infanticide in 1983. Baby Jane Doe was born with Down syndrome. She was mentally retarded. They said that she was mentally retarded. I read that to the degree where she probably could have held a job someday. Okay. But she was born with Down syndrome. The Indiana Supreme Court allowed the parents and the doctor to starve the baby, and the baby died after 12 days of starvation. It used to be in this country that if a baby was born with Down syndrome, that means that the baby needs some extra love. Now, however, if a baby's born with Down syndrome, it's like, you know, why the bother? But we call it mercy killing. We pretend we're doing them a favor, and then it maybe gets rid of our guilty conscience. Yeah, Tom.
No way, I'd like to tell you from a personal experience on Down syndrome. My first brother was born after he was born with Down syndrome. And the doctors told him at that time that there was nothing they could do for him. He was going to live to see his 18th birthday. He gained about the education of the sixth graders. Mm-hmm. He holds the full time job in Idaho.
Yeah.
He's dealing cars for a good car lot. And he's 42 years old.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And the other side of the coin was, even if he spent his whole life in bed and couldn't even get up, he's still a human being. And we don't judge the work by how productive the person is. But, yeah.
I got a question. Is that passive or active euthanasia when you withhold food from labor?
That's passive. That's passive unnatural. Because they didn't actively do it. They didn't give a lethal injection to kill the baby. They just withheld, they neglected to feed, and so the baby died, not of Down syndrome, which is not lethal, although it can bring down a person's life expectancy greatly, but they died unnaturally because they withheld food that they could have given to the baby. See, the thing is, a lot of these people would have died, not this case, but a lot of the people, like people in a coma, if you were in a coma for 200 days, years ago, you were going to die way before the 200th day because there was no way to feed you. But now technology has advanced and we have the ability to intravenously feed people. So that raises up a whole lot of other questions. But the thing is, if you have the means to feed someone who is starving and you don't, through neglect and through a passive manner, you're actually killing the person. Arguments for euthanasia. Here's some arguments for euthanasia. We won't respond to them directly, but some of the biblical things that we discuss, we'll touch on it, we'll kind of zero in on them. But here's some of the arguments for euthanasia. Everyone has the right to die with dignity. Everyone has the right to die with dignity. Now, number one,
There's a certain, you can have a certain element of dignity in death, but there is also a certain amount of shame in death. God did not create us to die. And we all got to do it. And when some people die slowly, it's sad, but they need us to be by their side and comfort them. They don't need us to walk in with an axe and give them a quote-unquote dignified death. Another argument for euthanasia is the constitutional right to privacy. Nowhere does the Constitution come right out and say you got a right to privacy, but there's certain things that imply that there is a certain amount of privacy the law-abiding citizen deserves. Never did our founding fathers ever think that should justify either suicide or homicide. It is an act of mercy to the sufferer. That's another response. I have to admit, in wartime situations, I could see the temptations. If you had a buddy who was laying there with his arms and legs blown off, blown in different directions, he's bleeding all over the place, and he's screaming at you to shoot him, your best friend, I could see the temptation to do it. At the same time, it is the doctor's job and it is other human beings' job to try to help along a person and to try to help heal them. It is not our job to kill them. We shoot horses. We don't shoot human beings. Another argument, it's an act of mercy to the suffering family. In other words, that suffering family is going to have an awful lot of guilt if they're not positive that what they did was right. Another argument, it relieves the family of heavy financial stress. We are on dangerous ground when we began to place price tags on human life. With this Clinton health plan, already they're looking into babies who are born that weigh under, premature babies that are born weighing under 1.5 pounds, and bypass surgery of adults who are over 80 years old. The costs are horrendous for both of those two extremes, and they're starting to make this known, which seems to imply that maybe they're saying after you're 80, you don't get a bypass, you just die. And if you're under 1.5 pounds, we don't treat you, we just put you aside and let you die. But we should never put a price tag on human life. It relieves society of a great social burden. Here's the Adolf Hitler master race type of thing. If they don't fit into our perfect definition of what a perfect human being is, let's get rid of them. Now, I tell you, maybe some healthy American can look at somebody less healthy than them and say, well, they don't deserve to live, and can really think that. But if somebody like Michael Jordan or Bo Jackson was ever to determine what is healthy and what is not, probably everybody in this room would get, none of us are the athletes that they are. So, that's very subjective what you're going to define as this is the perfect human being. Anything less than that is substandard and we're going to put to death. I don't think we want to head in that direction. And then there's the argument we kill animals to relieve their suffering. And that's right, we kill animals to relieve their suffering, but humans were created in God's image. And that's where the real debate is. The real question comes up, do you believe that a human being is created in God's image and that human life is sacred, or do you believe that a human being is just a highly evolved ape? Do you believe that humans are just animals? Now, I'm all for killing animals. What did you give me today, Kurt? Chicken fajita sandwich. I'm all for killing animals. I like steak. I like hamburgers. I like chicken. I like sausage. I got some friends in California. They got a pig as a house pet. And when I see a pig, that's bacon, that's ham, that's maybe some pork chops, but that's about it, But I don't think we should abuse the gifts that God has given us and do what we did to the buffaloes. But at the same time, I'm all for killing animals for food. I think it's a great idea. But if I believed that humans were also animals, if I really believed that and was consistent with that, with my view of, you know, these, the New Agers that are for animal rights and stuff, they don't scare me as much as the evolutionists who like a good steak. Because, you know, it makes me wonder if human, if we're just animals, if human meat was tasty, you know, why not? And, but it's interesting too, when God in Genesis 9, when he tells man that now, okay, now the flood is over and all, now you can start eating, besides vegetation, you can start eating animals. Right after that, God says in Genesis 9:6 that whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. In other words, yeah, you can kill animals for food, but don't go around killing humans. And so it's right there in the same context, but yeah, we kill animals to relieve their suffering, but humans and our animals, if you believe in evolution, especially without God, then, you know, humans are just animals, and euthanasia would make sense. But if we're creating God's image and human life is sacred, then euthanasia, the passive unnatural and active euthanasia, is murder. Let's take a look at some of the arguments against euthanasia. Job 1:21. Job 1:21. Job said this, and he said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Job recognized that the Lord is the giver of life, and the Lord alone has the authority to take life. Now, to defend ourselves, we can kill somebody else. Also, to defend a nation, we can kill others. We can execute criminals, but these are all things that God told us we could do. It was His authority invested in us. But God alone has the authority to take human life. That's why God could command the Israelites in the Old Testament to kill every man, woman, and child of the Canaanites. God is the giver of life. He has the right to take it. But when we take it upon ourselves to do those kinds of things, we do not have that authority. So God alone, number one, God alone is sovereign over human life. Job 1:21. In Exodus chapter 20, verse 13, "Thou shalt not kill." God condemns murder. Genesis 1:26-27 and Genesis 9:6 are passages we talk about. Man was created in God's image. Man was created in God's image. Therefore, human life is sacred. The animals were not created in God's image. Man was created in God's image. Therefore, if man, one man sheds another man's blood, then human government is the... If one man premeditatedly murders another man, human government is then to execute that man because of the sanctity of human life. See, and a lot of people think that that's a contradiction, capital punishment. They say, well, how can you promote the sanctity of human life by killing Ted Bundy? Well, see, number one, Ted Bundy killed innocent people. He murdered innocent people. Ted Bundy is not an innocent man himself. Number two, we take no joy and no pleasure in executing Ted Bundy, but at the same time, the punishment, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, the punishment must fit the crime. Jesus never took back eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth given to a government. What he took back was the misapplication of that to a person's personal life, to where it justified revenge. Jesus said, no, no, Mike, don't go out there and get your own revenge. Turn the other cheek. But as far as the government, still eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. What that means is, if somebody kills me, his life should be taken. But in Washington, D.C., where you premeditatedly murder somebody and you get an average of 2.3 years of prison time for each murder you commit, that'd be like if I stole $1,000 from Mike and the judge found me guilty and ordered me to pay him back $70. You say, well, that's not fair. That's right. That's not fair. That's not just. Nor is it just that one man will suffer, will go to prison for 2 years after taking someone else's entire life from him. The man was created in God's image. Also, we learn from our sufferings. Look at James 1, 2-4. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. It's also mentioned in Romans 5, verses 3 and 4. Romans 5, 3 and 4, that through our sufferings, we actually learn things. God has a lesson for us to learn in them. And not only this, but we also exult in our tribulations, knowing that tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance, proven character, and proven character, hope. And hope does not disappoint, because the love of God has been poured out within our hearts through the Holy Spirit who was given to us. Now, this isn't a karma type thing like it is with the Hindus, where if you help someone who's suffering, then the guy's got to reincarnate and suffer for that stuff all over again, and you're just keeping him in the cycle of reincarnation longer. So you don't. When somebody's starving, you let them starve, and you're going to be consistent with Hinduism. But with Christianity, part of the good that can come out of someone's sufferings is the effect it can have on others, and the fact that it causes us to have compassion on those who are sick, and we can help them and be by their side when they suffer. And sometimes we can alleviate the pain. Also, there is no price tag on human life. Look at the Gospel of Mark, chapter 8, verse 36. There is no price tag on human life. Look at what this verse says about the value of human life. Mark chapter 8 and verse 36. Jesus is speaking, and he says, "For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul?" So Jesus is saying, the soul of one man is worth more than all the world's riches. Okay? By the way, the same word for soul is the same word for life throughout the scriptures, throughout the New Testament. But whatever the case, there's no price tag on human life. A human is of infinitely more value than the riches that this world has to offer. Matthew 6 and verse 26. Matthew 6 and verse 26. Look at the birds of the air that they, Jesus is speaking again. Look at the birds of the air that they do not sow, neither do they reap, nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth much more than they? Now you ask that question to some of these New Agers, and they'll say, no. That bird's got as much right to life as you have. And with rights, rights always involve responsibilities. Okay? And when you watch these birds poking out the eyes of other birds, and when you watch a lion or a shark devouring other fish and stuff like that, that's the code they live by. They're animals. They don't have rights. The reason why we don't go around indiscriminately slaughtering animals is not because animals have rights, but because animals are a gift of God to us. God gave us dominion over the earth, and therefore we do not abuse the gifts that God has given us. So we don't pollute the earth, not because we worship the earth, but because we have to be faithful stewards of the gifts God's given us. And we don't slaughter animals indiscriminately, not because the animals have rights, but because it's wrong for us to do it. But this whole idea of animal rights thing is way out for lunch. They should be protected only because it's right for humans to protect animals that aren't going to be used for food or used for other purposes. Constitutional arguments. Those are the biblical arguments against euthanasia. Constitutional arguments. The right to privacy is at best only implied in the Constitution, okay? Nowhere does it come right out and say, you have a right to privacy and all that. Some of the search and seizure laws and stuff like that seem to imply a certain level of privacy. But the way these people talk about right to privacy for euthanasia and abortion, if you follow that line of reasoning out, if a guy wants to shoot heroin in the privacy of his home, or sell dope in the privacy of his home, it would seem that that'd be justified. There's some out there, the libertarians and all, but then there's also no constitutional right to kill. All men have an inalienable right to life, according to our founding fathers. I heard a great lecture the other day. This guy was real, was right on and stuff on a lot of things, but one thing he made a mistake on, though, was he said that our founding fathers gave us the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. No, our founding fathers never claimed to give us those rights. They said that they were God-given rights, which made them inalienable rights. In other words, if you are a human being, you have these rights. No one can take them from you. Now, you can infringe on the rights of another, but that doesn't take the rights away from them. You could fail to recognize the right that another person has, but that doesn't take the rights from us. As far as they're concerned, just the fact that we were humans mean that we had these rights and they were inalienable. You could not take them from men. But all men have an inalienable right to life. Other arguments, it is not merciful to kill a sufferer. It is not merciful to kill a sufferer. You know, who is it? The angel of mercy walks in the room. What does he do? He kills the guy. It doesn't make sense. Number two, the end does not justify the means. Adolf Hitler really thought that the answer to the problems in Germany was to, number one, slaughter the Jews and experiment on them, and then, number two, take over all of Europe. The end does not justify the means. You might say, well, I want to do a good thing. You might say, hey, I would make the best president. Of any American, I would make the best president. And so you run for president, you realize the three guys that are running against you, you don't stand a chance against them, and so you kill them. And the end does not justify the means. Even if it was true, you would make the best president, and it does not justify killing your competition. Another argument, again, humans are not animals. Although many humans do act like animals, humans are not animals. Another argument, euthanasia assumes atheistic evolution to be true. The Christians, I believe, and there are some Christians that disagree with me, but the Christians who hold to euthanasia, I believe they're inconsistent with their belief system. And I could be wrong, but I don't think I am. And also, euthanasia cheapens the value of human life. Where are you going to draw the line? I mean, if we already killed a baby just because you had Down syndrome, where are you going to draw the line? What about if somebody has a nervous breakdown and he's causing you a lot of stress? You know, where are you going to draw? What if you decide what we need is a one world religion? And everybody get together and hold hands, and these Christians don't want to go with you on this one world religion. Maybe we should get rid of them. Maybe they're the undesirables. Hey, if we define so many sinful views and sinful habits as diseases, which they really aren't, maybe someday the politically correct of our day are going to define Christianity as a disease, and then therefore say that we should put these people out of their misery. So euthanasia cheapens the value of human life, and euthanasia also produces guilt in the family and society. Okay, a few guidelines on natural passive euthanasia, the kind that is okay. That is permissible. It's allowing someone to die by natural means, and that is not, not always wrong. Now, and I might have implied that this is always right, that there's probably some cases, some scenarios where you could think of where you just allow a person to die naturally. For instance, you could actually have, I guess to a certain degree, if a guy was bleeding to death from an accident and needed to be taken to the emergency room, but you decided not to call 911, it would be a passive act, and he would die naturally, he would bleed to death, but there in that case, that would definitely be wrong. So there are cases of natural passive euthanasia.
Well, wouldn't that be unnatural because you were specific withholding of even refusing to staunch the blow?
Yeah, but in the definition of the unnatural, see, with the unnatural, this guy's dying of cancer, but he starves to death. Nothing to yet. You see what I'm getting at? Whereas in this one, he's bleeding to death, and he does bleed to death and die. So there are cases when natural passive euthanasia would be unjustified. But so here's the guidelines so that we'll know when they are justified. Withholding... And it's still gray area, but withholding unnatural means of sustaining life isn't always wrong, such as the chemotherapy. If the guy doesn't want the chemotherapy, he shouldn't be forced to take it. We shouldn't have our goal set on prolonging death if we can't really prolong life. In other words, this thing's going to kill him in the next day or two, and he doesn't want it to drag on for 3 months. We shouldn't have to take extraordinary means to make it drag on for 3 months. We're just prolonging his death. We're not really prolonging his life. Geisler says in his ethics book on page 168, keeping a comatose person, it's a person in a coma, keeping a comatose person who has an incurable disease alive on a machine when he is irreversibly dying is unnecessary. Okay? What he's saying, he's not saying that you don't feed intravenously people who are in a coma. But what he's saying is if the disease is going to kill that person that's in a coma or whatever, to just drag that person's life on, which is really just prolonging the death, is unnecessary.
So this would be the kind of thing where he's on a heart machine, he's on dialysis, his lungs aren't working.
Yeah. And that's pretty much, no court ever had to intervene. Doctors, just a good professional decision, pulling the plug in those cases for a long time. Sometimes if the family is really against it, they'll stick it out, just out of respect for the family, but yeah.
So to get off on the briar patch, what about, I don't even know how scientifically valid it is, but like all this cryogenic stuff, you know, we'll freeze them and hopefully we'll find a cure. What if that's, you know, what if that's a hope that they're holding out for? How does that factor into it?
Yeah, save that question for the next lecture, okay? It's coming right, very next lecture. We're going to deal with that and stuff like that, and freezing embryos. There's a lot of crazy stuff. Okay, but here's some of the guidelines here. Number one, the disease must be irreversible. See, it's a disease that causes the death, not the angel of mercy standing there with the lethal injection or just deciding to withhold food or whatever. The disease must be irreversible. The patient, if conscious, has veto power. You grab that plug and the patient says, get your stinking hands off of that, and you know, listen to him. The patient in conscience has veto power. The patient's living will comes into play. If he says, do everything, just keep me alive, you know, the patient's living will is going to come into play. And the living will is okay so long as it goes by the guidelines we've already discussed. Sometimes if the person is not alive, it should be maybe a collective decision with the doctors, lawyers, family members, and even the pastor. If the family is a Christian family and they want to refer to the pastor, his opinion should be looked into. Natural, see, when you
when you die naturally, okay, here's where it gets confusing. When you die naturally, it means that only unnatural means have been withheld. Okay? But the natural means have been provided. I know it sounds kind of weird, but natural means would be food, water, and oxygen. You can't deny that stuff to people who need it to keep them going and all. Unnatural means, Geisler classifies as artificial heart, kidney machine, respirator, basically the things that are they're doing the things for the body parts. I suppose it's possible to take a guy who's been dead for a week and take his body and hook it up on machines and actually pump blood through the different areas of the body, and then the guy wouldn't be alive. And so I think that's one of the things that Geisler was getting at, is that the disease is irreversible. You know, we're eventually going to die, you know. There's no need to prolong the death. Proverbs 31, 6 and 7, Geisler points to a real good passage here. Proverbs 31, 6 and 7. Solomon says, give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to him whose life is bitter. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his trouble no more. Solomon doesn't say, hey look, if a guy is afflicted, kill him. Solomon said, give him a little bit of booze if that's what it takes to ease the pain. That's what death with dignity is, being there and loving the person and spending time with them and comforting them and trying to ease that pain for them, not putting them to death. Geisler says on page 170, the dying should be shot with a sedative, but not a bullet. Another guideline, accept treatment that will prolong life, not death. And we may choose to refuse kidney dialysis or chemotherapy, things like that, unnatural means that just might prolong death. That the person might decide they don't want to take those things. Artificial heart would be an unnatural.
No, I mean, a kidney transplant, a live kidney from a donor to a person.
I think that would still be unnatural. I myself, I'd take it. I don't think it's something you really should be able to force on somebody in an area like that. And Geisler points out, eventually we will all die. Hebrews 9:27 is the point of man to die once and then come to judgment. Of course, if Christ returns first, we might be able to escape that, but for all practical purposes, we're all going to die. And so this idea that we're going to try to make ourselves live forever, that's unnecessary. At the same time, we should not be in the business of killing to alleviate suffering.